Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
Okay, hello and welcome to this month's episode of Conversations for a Brave New World. I'm Alicia McFarlane, lecturer in paramedicine at Charles Sturt University, stepping in as your guest presenter for the show. This month, we're diving into a conversation that's close to my heart, gender equality and the role of women in politics. And who better to help us unpack it all than Professor Rosalind Dixon, legal powerhouse, change maker and co-lead of the new University of New South Wales Gender Equality Hub. It promises to be thoughtful, empowering and maybe even a little bit bold, just how we like it. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome Roz to the conversation today. Currently, Professor Dixon serves as a Professor of Law at the University of New South Wales, where her research focuses on areas such as constitutional design, democratic resilience, and the intersection of law and gender. Roz is a fierce advocate for gender equality and the kind of person who makes you wonder if she secretly does have 36 hours in her day. Roz is at the forefront of turning research into action and ideas into lasting change, all while keeping a sharp sense of humour, a relentless focus on justice. We're so lucky to have her here to talk to all things equality, representation, and why politics looks better with women in it. And Roz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Alicia, thanks for having me. What a joy to be with you and all your listeners.
Thanks so much. And look, I suppose the best place to start is obviously at the beginning, but you've been a long time advocate for gender equality. And can you tell us a little bit about where that started, what drives your ongoing passion and what your thoughts for the future are? Big question, but let's start there.
Yeah, and I think it's such a timely question because if you work on equality right now, you're feeling pretty discouraged and possibly a bit beleaguered given the sort of rhetoric coming out of the US. And so going back to like, where does this come from and why does it matter, I think is a really great and powerful way to start. I always think it's hard to pinpoint exactly where we get our ideas from and our passions. Mm-hmm. I think for me, I grew up in a household with two lawyers. Mum and dad both were lawyers. Mum had a prior career as a high school teacher. And I think she always felt a lot of professional frustration. She's a bit older than my dad. In her earlier life, she, you know, lost her tenure as a high school teacher when she got married. She had huge obstacles in her career. She wasn't shy about reminding me that I was one of them, even though she loved me dearly. And I think I had a real sense growing up of like, wow, it's hard to have two people doing busy jobs and have a family. It's a bit of awareness from the time I was little and watching people around me and I dare say some of my own struggles occasionally. And also, if you're interested in the world and politics, as you and I both are, Alicia, you can't help but look around the world and just see that women and girls are bearing huge amounts of care work that is unrecognized and unrewarded. They're subjected to sexual and family violence at just vastly disproportionate rates and poverty in various parts of their life cycle. And it's not shifting at nearly the pace we want it to. And so I think the more you're aware of the world, the more you think, gee, there's still a problem with gender equality that's pretty pressing and pretty global.
Yeah, there is some traction there and we are making some headway, but it's certainly, personally, it's not at a pace that I'm enjoying and it doesn't seem to be at a pace that you're enjoying either. So I was listening to what you were saying and I think it's really interesting to talk about, you know, one of my questions was going to be about defining moments in your career, but perhaps it comes from not one individual defining moment or even two or three, but in fact, an entire life cycle of something that you've witnessed, whether it be personally or indirectly. It sounds like there's been lots of contributing factors to maybe where you've arrived today and maybe where you'll go in the future.
You know, some people they do have those aha moments in their career where they're like, gee, I can pinpoint the moment where it all happened. Mm. You know, I went and did postgraduate study in America and I was thinking about doing it in England and I would have had a different life if I'd done that. So I think that was a big shift in how I thought and also who my friends are and where my life trajectory went. But I think on gender, it's always been the small things, you know, the repeated things that you experience and you witness that add up to a pattern that you think it just is wrong and has to change. One of the things about people who are resilient is they let a lot of that stuff go, keep going. And you're like, but I think the older you get, the more you're like, well, okay, I've made my peace with all the great things I've benefited from, but also all the challenges I've had to navigate. But I don't want the generation that my students or my kids to have exactly the same struggles of different pieces of the puzzle, but really clear pattern of implicit bias and structures that don't really work for people and try and say, well, how do we use the time we've got and the, you know, different vantage points that we all have in the system to make positive change?
Interesting that you talk about what we make our peace with, this gender equality hub that you've just launched. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and perhaps maybe some of those experiences that will lead to maybe some of the projects that you'll undertake?
Yeah, I mean, so the key impetus for this gender hub is a program that you were a part of, Alicia, and which we both share a connection to, which is the Pathways to Politics for Women program. And that's a program which is now run in every state and territory across Australia and gives women and non-binary individuals interested in electoral office support, encouragement, mentoring, and a set of skills to try and encourage them to take that leap if it's right for them to run for office. And it's, you know, across the regions and the cities, it's across all parties and independents. And I've now been involved in that program for almost 5 years and really enjoyed it, meeting women from across the state who have these amazing stories, like, you know, you and people in your cohort. And the hub is really just an attempt to create a home for Pathways and other programs like it. We're doing programs to encourage diverse girls, including many of our girls in immigrant communities in Western Sydney, to think about business and economics as careers, to think about leadership and possibly some politics training, let's see, but mainly to sort of expand the work of the Pathways program around training and mentoring, encouraging and upskilling, but also to do some research in public engagement, which I do from time to time on issues like family violence and the economics of gender equality, because I have a strong interest in the link between law, but also the politics and economics and the triangle between law, politics and economics. So I've got a couple of past ideas around superannuation, childcare and tax, and we're continuing to push those ideas forward, and also working on a new report on flexible work and tax and how to use the payroll tax system to try and give greater incentives for employers to promote flexible work, because part-time job sharing flexible work is, I think, a really important part of the missing piece. The fundamentals of care and the unequal distribution of care work continues to be a major driver in Australia of the gender pay gap. Figuring out how to redistribute that burden and allow women and men to do paid and care work in a more seamless way is a big part of the challenge on that side of things.
Interesting that you bring up flexible workplace and caring responsibilities. The federal election's just been announced. Busy time for you ahead, busy time for all of us. But I think what's really important, that seemed to be a really key topic of discussion. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts. How big of an impact do you think it will have on the upcoming election?
Peter Dutton had made an announcement about wanting to have people back in the office for the federal public sector. And there's a bit of a concern about that in terms of flexible work practices and the advantages of productivity and inclusion that come with a lot of those practices. But he said, interestingly, oh, well, if it's a problem, we can have more job sharing, which is something I'm very passionate about. And I thought that was pretty interesting. So it's good to see both sides are paying attention to these issues, even though they're coming up with quite different answers. At the moment, my sense is that the opposition hasn't fully grappled with the importance of courting female voters on issues that are of top concern. Women voters are voters, and they care a lot about all the issues that all voters care about, you know, which is cost of living and, you know, basic goods, energy, food and fuel and housing. And often women are the ones who do the family budget, so they're even more worried about it. But women also care more than a lot of blokes about funding for women's health, for childcare, for kind of things that really do affect cost of living, but also women's working lives and family lives in a very direct way. And as of now, I don't see any big announcements from the coalition that will really move the dial on female support for the coalition. And that's where they need to win, other than in a minority government with the Teals, where again, they'll be forced to make some important concessions on issues like climate integrity, but also the issues that really affect women directly. I think we need to see more from the coalition on those issues for them to really have a chance of forming majority government. I certainly haven't been shy about telling people on that side of politics that view. I'm sure others are too, and we'll see. We'll see if they're listening or if they're going to roll the dice on a more traditional Liberal National agenda, which tends to play better amongst blokes than women.
Yeah, we're certainly in for an interesting 5 weeks, aren't we? Everyone's approach and how it shifts. And if it does move the needle, as you suggest, or if they're willing to roll the dice. I suppose we've talked about women's votes. Let's talk about women in politics. So what's the importance of having more women inside politics, other than obviously just trying to reach that concept of critical mass?
It's a good question, because again, like the way we started the conversation, you've got to go back to fundamentals and say, well, why does it matter? Elon Musk and Donald Trump really want to get rid of all of these efforts to promote parity or greater gender equality. And when you have that as the backdrop, you've got to say, well, why do we care? I think there are three key key reasons. They're reasons that do suggest the importance of diverse women and women from all different walks of life, people who are in relationships, who are single parents, people who are younger, who are older, who are from the regions as well as from the cities, and people from more political backgrounds, but also racial cultural backgrounds. And our parliament is still far, far more monocultural than our society. And I think that's a problem. So it's not just about women, it's about diverse women in our politics. For the community to trust politics and democracy, they need to see themselves represented in it. And that doesn't mean there's a one-for-one connection. You can be represented by anyone who listens to you and does a good job of advocating for your interests. But if time and time again, it's all white blokes representing you, you start to feel like maybe your interests aren't fully taken into account. I think it matters for public confidence and trust in democracy. So I think number one is public trust and therefore stability of our constitutional system. The second is better decision making. So, you know, laws affect diverse communities in different ways. We make better laws when we've got people in the parliament and in the public service who can decide how to frame laws cognizant of the variety of human experience in society. And that means women and men, not just men. You've got to have a parliament and a public service, but especially a parliament that's making laws for the experiences of the entire community, including diverse women and girls. And then the third argument is it's just about fairness, which is everyone should have a fair go in Australia, particularly, it's our founding mantra, at pursuing important jobs. And politics is an important job. It really affects our lives in really direct and indirect ways. And when you exercise that kind of public power, it should be exercised on terms of substantive equality. It's about trust. It's about better laws, and it's about fairness. But I do want to emphasize, it's not just about having someone in a dress. It really is about making sure that those people come from their community and rooted in their community and speak for their community and win their community's trust, and that they're from diverse cultural, economic, regional, political backgrounds, professional backgrounds as well, and that they're going to take seriously the trust that we put in them to do a good job. You know, one of the things I've been studying in different countries is the ways in which some of the would-be authoritarian parties and leaders have been picking up on this commitment to gender equality and using and abusing it for their own ends. So they find women to put as more or less the front for their own illiberal, anti-democratic policies that erode women's rights, you know, take away women's equality, women's reproductive rights, women's workplace rights. And then they have a woman as the spokesperson just to make it more palatable without giving that person meaningful agency, voice, or taking seriously the need for that person to be embedded in their community in order to speak with real credibility about women's experiences.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I think traditionally Australians, and I probably can't speak to globally as you can, but I think Australians have traditionally not been great at accepting women in politics. We've certainly given them a hard time in the past and continue to do in the present. We seem to judge women differently in politics to the way that we judge men. The Pathways to Politics programs was having those really open discussions about the barriers to entering politics and what they actually look like. From your perspective, what are the ongoing small and big barriers to more women engaging in politics and more people being fairly represented?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a confidence gap, there's a care and family challenge, and then there is the sort of differential hate and misogyny that women encounter on top of what is already a fairly high base of attacks on our political leaders. We do know that women and minorities tend to rate themselves more harshly because of social conditioning and messaging from the time we're really little around performance, especially public performance. And so I think that we come into political life with less confidence relative to our male competitors. And politics is a confidence game, you know? You got to stand for pre-selection, you got to stand for election, you got to take wins and losses, you got to keep going. Sometimes you got to have a bad hair day in public and be fairly embarrassed by the fact that, you know, your mistakes are pretty public when you're in politics. You know, most of us, when we make a mistake at work, maybe half a dozen people say it's embarrass ourselves. And whereas when you make a mistake in politics, it's pretty public. And so you got to have a lot of confidence in yourself to be able to go in to start with, but also to keep going when things are a bit tougher. I think, you know, I try really hard as a uni teacher to teach my students that we all make mistakes, get used to it and don't feel ashamed of it. And resilience is about being okay with that, because it's not easy, but we all do it. And it's all part of human experience and putting yourself out there and giving yourself opportunities to do great things. But I don't think we say that enough generally. We talk about resilience, you know, in an important way, but not enough, and not in a way that gives women and girls to give it a go and to get it wrong. The second thing is, and of course, as you know from Pathways, one of the things we're trying to do in the Pathways program is help people on that and help challenge people a bit and say, look, there are lots of reasons not to run for office, but confidence shouldn't be one of them because you're all amazing and you've all got something to bring and offer. The slick Barbie doll version of women in politics isn't the version we want. We want the people who are real, who are rooted in community and experience, and who aren't there as representatives of an ideal, but as representatives of themselves and their community. Second point is just time and family, which is your family cops it in politics. You know, there's no privacy. You can't be a teenager and get drunk at a party without worrying that someone's going to take a picture and put it on social media. There's lots of costs on family. And then there's the cost of your family members being away and being at evening events in the electorate or in your colleague's electorate, being on the campaign trail, being in Canberra or in Sydney if you're in, you know, state parliament in a way. So it's a really tough game when it comes to family and care responsibilities. I think, you know, someone who has had a lot of responsibility for two terrific teenagers with lots of challenges, I really think that should be taken seriously. And it's one of the reasons that as part of my Pathways and my hub role, I'm so committed to policy reform, including making big and small changes to how parliament operates from a care perspective, on a scheduling, making sure people don't have to fly when they could be online, making sure that people have the support on childcare that they need. But it's not easy. It's not easy in any walk of life, and politics, it's even harder. And then the third challenge is that, you know, men and women are being subjected to more and more online hate. I still remember Greg Hunt, when he stepped down as Minister for Health, talked about the personal toll and the toll on his family for all the hate directed at him during COVID. Hunt made up some bad calls, in my view. I think we should have bought more vaccines and bought them early. I don't think the government did everything right on COVID, but I think he worked his absolute guts out. He did a pretty good job. And I think the fact that, you know, when you do that for a good salary, but not the high salary you could earn, and you spend a lot of time away from your family, and the reward is death threats and vile comments online that you and your family see, I think it's a very tough price to pay. I personally think the work of the eSafety Commission is really critical in this regard, and we need to do more. We can't shut down free speech, but we have to work harder on stopping people being vilified. And unfortunately for women, these kinds of threats and nasty online trolling sort of behaviours tend to be even more violent and more pernicious and involve threats of sexual violence as well as death. And they end up involving very personal comments on appearance and demeanour and ways of behaving that are really undermining. People who serve in public life really cop a lot. I really would like us to work harder to change it. I think it means we need to recognise that a big burden is placed on our political leaders. I always say to people when they're like, I've had enough of our politicians, I'm like, well, why? Tell me specifics, because this kind of like, they're all terrible attitude, and Australia tends to have a bit of that, you know, don't get ahead of yourself, no one's too good. And I like that part of our egalitarian culture, but sometimes it's just pulling people down, and then it intersects with online trolling in a way that's really problematic. So the third is the online culture of hate that is particularly bad for diverse women. And we're doing important things to counter via the work of the police and the eSafety Commission, but we need to do more. And we need to do more as a society and just call it out. And when your mates put some sort of hateful message on social media against our leaders, tone it down, mate. Like, that is just a bit too strong. It's not this person in particular I care about. It's the fact that by talking that way, you're stopping the next generation of brilliant young people who could contribute to our public debate and public life from ever wanting to do it in the first place.
It's a great point, talking about what is the purpose of it? Is the purpose of it to vent? Is the purpose of it to put that particular person or those sets of ideas down? Or is the purpose to actually diminish any blame, I suppose, that might be there for the next generation? Because at times it can feel a little bit like that. There's an ulterior motive, perhaps, that, you know, the next generation will look at it and think, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. And I'm a big believer in Occam's razor, which is the logical premise that, you know, you go for the easiest explanation, not the most complicated one. I don't think anyone's trying to discourage young people, but that's the effect. I think the aim is, agreed, have a rant, You know, who doesn't love a rant? We all love
the keyboard warrior. Yeah.
Yeah, but the rants online just get out of control and so nasty. And people don't think through who's at the other end of this, who's receiving this message, how do they feel, how do their family feel, and how is it going to be read by people reading it from afar and thinking, oh, this could be me.
On that, there is bullying, there is sexism, all of that is rife in lots of workplaces, let's be honest. It's not just in politics. It's also definitely inside those workplaces that are deemed to be traditionally masculine. But from any perspective, I suppose with all of your background knowledge, what are the ways that both men and women, so you say calling it out, what does that actually look like? How do we then use social media in a positive way?
Calling it out when it's about you has to be exceptional and it has to be done exceptionally well. So Julia Gillard's misogyny speech was an example of that. She didn't usually talk about those issues. So that when she did, it was very powerful and she did it just so well. And sure, there was a political context to that speech, but it was just a brilliant speech and it went viral. When you're calling it out for yourself, don't do it often. But when you do it really clearly and really well. But I was really talking about the role of the bystander in saying, mate, shut up. That's just over the line.
Right.
And so that we can all self-regulate better by hearing our mates tell us that being a bit tough on this, but just ease off a little bit. Come on now. It's that sort of peer feedback around how we talk about our leaders and each other that can be helpful. When I talk to people in the Pathways program, people like you think about, is it actually worth it doing all of this? It's worth it if it aligns with your family. Family's always more important than anything else. And so if it's going to be not right for your family, you shouldn't do it. But if it's about getting some hate online, I would say you've got to find a way to move through that if you know why you want to be there. It means that politics is really only rewarding for those people who have a vision of why they want to be there. And that's kind of a good thing because we want people there to make change and for the right reasons. But then there's lots of practical tips we give people in the course, which is don't check your social media, have someone else do it for you. Use social media proactively to let people know you're doing good things, but don't listen to the chatter on it. Get your feedback through other mechanisms. Be out there in the community. Talk to people. Listen. Try and filter out the noise. And if there's a credible threat, refer it to the police and the eSafety Commissioner and move on. You know, it's the same in everything in life. If you listen to your haters and only to your haters, you'd never do anything.
No, you're right. And actually a big part of the course that I really enjoyed was the session, well, how do you manage social media and how you do you manage that online hate that can be thrown at you? I suppose the more public a figure you become, the more frequent those experiences can be. And so all of those practical tips that you just outlined, whilst they might seem to some people, maybe they seem simple, maybe it's something that you already do. To me, they certainly weren't something that I had considered. Yeah. Do you actually need to see that? Is that a productive thing to be a part of? Or actually, can I sort that out for you? And you can move on with your day and move towards all those goals and values that you're working towards anyways. I definitely walked away, you know, not just with the tips and tricks, but also having listened to other women that had experienced that and what their experiences were, having come in from maybe where I am through to far more experience.
And the other thing I take from hearing people who are the sort of social media experts and the journalists is that it does, you get more flack the you know, more prominent you are, but you also get more immune to the flack. No one gets immune to serious threats to their personal safety, and that's why we should take them so seriously and use all the legal tools available to prevent that kind of misconduct. Like, I do think, just want to stress how damaging I believe that kind of discourse is to our democracy, and why I think the work of the eSafety Commission and the police in this regard is so important. But the kind of low-level insults, you do get more immune to it. I think that's true in general with life and with gender, which is when you've had a few knocks, you kind of know how to deal with it the next time. It's really important that those of us who are mid-career and older, who have kind of got used to some of the stuff being challenging, don't just give in to that for the next generation. That we feel proud that we've learnt to navigate the obstacles and find our own source of support and strength to get through them, but that we then go, you know what, I'm now in a position to be the manager or be the policy change maker, and I'm going to use the tools to try and make things a little bit better.
Love it. Final thought. If you could give anyone any advice to, whether they be a young woman, a woman about to enter politics, maybe a woman that's in a workplace that wants to undertake a leadership position, what's one of those amazing tips or tricks you might have?
Oh, there's no one, Alicia. There's too many. So believe in yourself more than you currently think is possible. Like, really back yourself and back yourself further than you think you deserve, right? It's the fake it until you make it. Believe in yourself until you actually feel it. The second is always go back to your purpose and why you're doing it, right? It's not selfish. It's not about self-promotion. It's this is why I'm doing this and this is why it matters. And the fact that some people might hate me for it, oh, well, because they don't know what I know, which is that I'm doing this for a really good reason. And the third is to make sure you have support. But I think the one thing I would say about being female identifying is always a voice that sort of says, who do you think you are? Why do you think you're good enough? Why do you think that, you know, anyone will like you or that you're special, you're not special? It's that voice that we're kind of given from wherever when we're young. And it's worse if you're from a background where, whether it's class or geography or race or culture, where that's amplified. But just call that voice out in your own head. It's going to be hanging around and you just got to say, nah, go away, Bob. I'm good. Thanks,
and
Bob.
And challenge what those thoughts are and they come from. Are they your own or are they actually just something that you've picked up along the way and is a reflection of maybe the moment of low self-esteem or lack of confidence or something that's happened to you that day rather than actually the true picture of what's happening? It's a great way to end the show today, Roz. Thanks so much for joining us. Look forward to chatting with you more in the future about all those fantastic things the Gender Equality Hub will achieve, I'm sure.
Thanks for having me. Great chatting.
Pleasure.
Well, that brings us to the end of another great show. But before we go, let's hear from our co-hosts, Associate Professors Donna Bridges, Cliff Lewis, and myself, Sonia Varia.
So Clifford, we were just talking about, you had some really interesting points. I think I'd like to ask you first, what were your thoughts about the interview that Alicia held today?
Well, I think there are so many different paths that ring so true. The idea about the need for representation and diversity in our political system as a way of bringing trust. And, you know, I know one of my sneaky ways about deciding who I vote for is to look at who is the most diverse portfolio of candidates, because that tells me at least I can hope that they consider people like me. You know, the other thing that was spoken about is this notion of building confidence for women to enter politics. And I found this really interesting because part of this was the idea about the vitriol candidates get on social media as a way of taking away from that confidence. And I can agree, I can totally see the point of it. But I also see the point of the importance of having constructive and informed conversation on social media about our candidates and about the policies our members of parliament are putting forward, because that helps demonstrate that transparency and holds people in the public eye accountable. Because it's not about being accountable once every 3 years when the election cycle rolls around. It's about holding them accountable constantly because they're still getting paid every day out of our taxpayer money.
Yeah, thanks, Cliff. I think that's really important. And with the elections coming up, I'm sure all of us have been watching social media and entering in discussions with our peers and obviously with people that we have nothing to do with either and getting their interesting views on or take on the policies that everybody is out there pushing. Donna, what about you? What are your thoughts?
Well, I thought she gave some really good advice for people who are in the public eye about how to handle social media, because we do know that women and people of colour get slammed on social media and they're not really focused on the political agenda. So if you're interested in that, I would definitely listen to her advice. It's a very timely piece, isn't it? Especially with all the messages that we're hearing from US politics. And I think many of us in this space are feeling disheartened and concerned. And so to hear that someone like Professor Roz Dixon is doing such good work at UNSW around DEI and that they're forwarding the issues and they're talking about politics at the moment, I was really heartened by that.
Well, I think that's a really good place that we'll end the conversations this week. So I hope you join us next month when Donna will be interviewing Jess Hill, who wrote the book See What You Made Me Do. That sounds like a really interesting interview, Donna. We'll look forward to listening to that. Thanks again, everyone, and have a great month.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by the Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google the Gender Network at Charles Sturt.